praise this time. One more salawat upon Muhammad and Ali Muhammad, please. A'udhu billahi minash shaitani rajim. Bismillahir rahmanir rahim. Alhamdulillahi rabbil alameen. Alhamdulillahi alladhi hadana lihadha. Wama kunna linahtadiya lawla an hadana Allah. Wa salatu wa salam ala ashraf al anbiya. Wa sayyidi al mursaleen wa shafi al muznibin. Sayyidina wa nabiyyina Abil Qasim Muhammad. Allahumma salli ala Muhammad wa ala Muhammad. Wassalatu wassalamu ala ahli baytih tayyibin tahirin al-ma'sumin al-madlumin al-muntajabin. La siyama maulana wa sayyidi sahib al-asri wa zaman. Ruhi wa arwahu al-alamin lahul fida. Wa ajjala Allahu ta'ala farajuhu sharif. Wa la'natu da'imatu ala a'da'ihim wa munkiri fadailihim ilalan ila qiyami yawmiddin amma ba'd rabbi shrah li sadri wa yassir li amri wa hlu luqdatan min lisani yafqahu qawli. For the hastening of the return of our 12th Imam, Imam al-Hujjah, one salawat upon Muhammad and Ali Muhammad. First off, just a bit of a clarification that although we are going to be speaking about the sixth Imam tonight, his birth isn't actually until Saturday. As we know that the birth of the sixth Imam and the Prophet fall on the same day, on the 17th of Rabi al-Awwal. So we will be speaking about the Imam, but the actual official birthday is on the Saturday. So just to ensure that our dates are in order and we recognize the fact that his birthday was not today in history. And whatever the case may be, at least we're dedicating tonight to the legacy of our sixth Imam. And it becomes easier for the speaker because now I don't have to crunch the life of two infallibles into a short time span. So this evening I'm going to focus specifically and exclusively on the life of our sixth Imam. And that means on Saturday when we gather for the food and as an extra part of the lecture, which is just a side dish, then we'll talk about the Prophet, inshallah. And we will give the honor and glory and the respect and love to the Rasulullah on Saturday as he rightfully deserves. But tonight, I want to look at the birth and the life of our sixth Imam, and specifically one topic, which is the advice to the youth from our sixth Imam. Now, I don't see many youth in the community tonight, unless we all are under 100, we're all youth, then we're okay in that demographic. But I want to look at the topic of how the sixth Imam addressed, at one level, the elders of the community, the movers, the shakers, the people responsible for the guidance of our societies, and also the guidance of the Imam directly to the youth. So we want to try to analyze both of those aspects from the direct ahadith of the sixth Imam. And before I do that, though, I do want to just very briefly speak a bit about the life of the Imam. And I don't want to go into too much details about the specifics of the Imam, but just to give us a bit of a background about our sixth Imam so we can better appreciate who he was and his time frame that he lived in. As I mentioned, he was born on the 17th of Rabi al-Awwal, the same day as Rasulullah, obviously 123 years after the birth of the Prophet. He was born in the year 80 after the Hijrah. And he was born in Medina. Obviously, Rasulullah was in Mecca. The sixth Imam is in Medina. And we believe that this is was not just a coincidence. It's not a fluke, you know, that the two people born on the same day. Obviously, there is a wisdom, there is a logic behind why Allah put the birth of the sixth Imam on the same day of the birth of the Prophet. And probably we'll look at that on Saturday. But we see that there is obviously that sharing of the birth anniversary. He attained the position of the imamate at a young age, relatively, at the age of about 34. And as we see that he had the longest imamate of all of the imams, except obviously our 12th imam, none can surpass him in imamate. But he had about a 28-year period. And his imamate is obviously interesting. All of the imams went through unique circumstances. But his was interesting because it came at the time of the decline of the Bani Umayyah, the Umayyad dynasty, and at the beginning of the Abbasid dynasty. And this is why, and I'm sure we've heard this umpteen times from the member, that this period was unique because it gave the sixth Imam, specifically the sixth Imam, but actually even all of the Muslim scholars of that time, he's not a scholar, obviously, he's the Imam, he's got students and people who are scholars, But he gave the sixth Imam and the scholars of his era an ideal opportunity to begin to teach Islam. I say teach Islam, and it sounds a bit strange, but keep in mind that from the time of the death of Rasulullah, right, until the time of around the decline, you know, for about 50 to 60 years, there was a prohibition within Islam, Muslim imposed prohibition on writing hadith, on speaking the words. To say qala Rasulullah was banned by the khulafa of the time. In fact, if you look at traditions, you will see that Abu Huraira, the very famous narrator of traditions, he himself has been quoted as saying that we dare ever say qala Rasulullah during the time of the second caliph because we feared the repercussions of the whip were we to quote Rasulullah. And so that period was very difficult for the Muslims, because if you can't quote the words of the Prophet, you're left with a Quran, but you're not allowed to quote what the Prophet said about the verses. You're not allowed to elaborate on Islam other than what was in the Quran. So the coming of the sixth Imam at that time was unique, because the Bani Umayyah were going towards their decline. Bani Abbas were beginning to cementing their authority. And between the two empires, a situation arose which allows the sixth Imam specifically, but hundreds if not thousands of scholars, to be able to come and listen to the sixth Imam, to begin to formulate opinions, to say the Messenger of Allah has said so and so, to speak their mind about Islamic theology, jurisprudence, many of the topics which were taboo. And so when we look at the life of the sixth Imam, it becomes unique because he's able to openly engage in discourse. He's openly able to sit on the minbar and give lessons, to speak about what the Prophet said, what the Prophet did, what the opinions of Islam are. And he has a unique opportunity, and he develops a system by which scholars of many different persuasions are being trained. Scholars are not only debating on Islamic theology, not only on ayat of the Quran, but they're tackling chemistry, geography, many of the sciences of the world today were being discussed and debated and formulated at the time of our sixth Imam, Imam Ja'far as-Sadiq alayhi salatu wassalam. Which brings me to the first thing I want to mention tonight, which is our identity. This is not my theme for tonight, but it is important for us to realize, because when we live in such an environment as we do today, especially here where we live in this particular region, we realize that our identity is many times slipping from our fingers. Maybe those who came from a foreign country to Canada, they maintain their identity to an extent. They haven't been sucked into this multicultural, homogenous society of Canada where everybody is made to be equal at one level. But the newer generation, because of money that is being pumped in by the petro countries who are, you know, exporting oil and their version of Islam, and other people who are saying things about the Muslim community, many times we find the newer generation are not sure of their identity within this fold of Islam. So let me take a few minutes just to break it down at who we are as Muslims, as followers of this religion of Islam. Obviously, first and foremost, we are Muslims. We are submitters to Allah. And that goes without saying. Coming into Islam, we have entered into submission to Allah. So our label, one of our labels, is a Muslim. But you know, today there is this trend, not today meaning today, but for the last, let's say, 20 to 30 years, a trend has happened in our society by so-called Muslim countries, organizations, institutions, where they say, don't say that you're Shia or you're this or you're that, just say you're Muslim. You know, sometimes you go to a person and you'll say, oh, you're Muslim. And you'll get into a discussion and they'll say, brother, I don't follow any madhab. I don't follow any tradition. I'm just a Muslim. But then you say, how do you pray? Oh, I pray like the Prophet prayed. Really? Okay. Well, how did the Prophet pray? Because the Quran doesn't tell me that. No, brother, don't get into these discussions. We're all Muslims. You know, let's just sit around and sing Kumbaya and we'll all be happy. There's no, you know, Shia Sunni difference. There's no labels. These are all just names you put on yourself. But we have to realize that this is a fallacy. The Rasulullah himself called us the Shia. Rasulullah, in the hadith of the non-Shia books, he would say to Ali, he said, "Ya Ali, you and your Shia are faizun, are the successful ones. You and your Shia are this, you and your Shia are that." Rasulullah would read Surah Bayyinah. He would say, "Ya Ali, you and your Shia are the epitome of Inna ladina amanu wa amalu salihat, ulaika hum khayrul bariyah." That you and your Shia are the best of humanity. The Quran says that even Ibrahim was a Shia. You can see in the Quran, Ibrahim is called a Shia of the preceding prophet. So labels, yes, they're just a label. Just like on your shirt, you have a label, GQ, whatever company you buy your clothing from. It tells you something though. Who made that clothing? What is the fabric of it? What is the quality of it? And so when we say that we're Shias of Ali, it doesn't mean we don't follow the Prophet. It doesn't mean we're not Muslims. We're Muslims, but we follow a specific thread of Islam. We follow Islam as taught by Ali and the family of Ali. And that's why we say, when people, because there are many Shias, Shia Ismaili, Shia Zaydi, Shia this and Shia that, all these groups call themselves as Shia. But we say we're Shia Ithna Ashari. We're Shias that follow 12 Imams. So we have a more unique identity. We're Muslims, but we follow Islam as taught by the Prophet and his family. We're Shia. We're Shia of Ali, but we're Shia of Ali that follow 11 other Imams. So we have an identity attached to ourselves. And then we say, as we are here tonight to commemorate the birth of our sixth Imam, we say that we're Ja'fari Shia. Have we ever thought why we call ourselves Ja'fari? We have the Ja'fari Islamic Center, the Ja'fari Community Center, Ja'fari this, Ja'fari that. We're all Ja'faris. We always hear this word. Why don't we say we're Alawi Shias? I know that has a negative connotation today, Alawis. But why are we not Alawi? We follow Imam Ali. Why are we not Hassanis, Husseinis, Sajjadis, Baqiris, Kadhimis, Radhawis, Askaris? We're Ja'fari Shia. Why did we pick the sixth Imam, or who picked the sixth Imam that our identity is under his name? Why don't we say we're Radhawi Shias? We love Imam Radha, don't we? Don't we love Imam Radha? Yes, no? Do we know who Imam Radha is? Are we sure? Who is Imam Radha? Eighth Imam. Okay, so people know, that's good. But why are we not Radhawi Imam Shias? Why are we not Shia Ithna Ashari Radhawi? Shia Ithna Ashari Kadhimi, Baqiri, Sajjadi? We're Ja'fari. There's a reason for that, right? It's a very protracted, long discussion. But to put in one or two sentences, as I mentioned, at the time of the Imam, our sixth Imam, there was a revolution of political ideologies, Bani Umayyah and Abbas, happening. That allowed an opportunity for the sixth Imam, a window for him, to begin to preach, again, to say, قَالَ رَسُولُ اللَّهِ, to say that the Messenger of God said this and that. He was free to propagate religion. He was free to begin to bring those hadith that had been forgotten for the last 80, 90 years, that were forbidden to be written. He was able to show those to the community. He was able to train scholars on what it means to be a Muslim. People were, you know, running around like, what is Islam? He was able to formulate an identity that this is what Islam is. And because of the, and this is just, again, very brief in a nutshell. You can research it more online if you would like. But he was given this opportunity to begin to form an identity of Islam, of Muslims, of Shia, Ithna Ashari. And he was able to form this through ideology, through the Aqidah, through commentary of Quran, through fiqh, through the ahkam, through akhlaq, through many different sciences he was bringing together. He brought all of this forth, and obviously his son started it, the fifth Imam, began the movement. The son, the sixth Imam, continues it. And because of this era where Islam is becoming more and more defined, and rules and regulations are being written, and texts are being translated, and scholars are debating, this whole environment, this whole intellectual revolution of the Imam brings light to why we are called the Ja'fari. Yes, we are Alawi in the terms of our love of Imam Ali. Yes, we're Hassani and Husseini in the terms of, in the way of our outlook on justice and standing for justice. Yes, we are Sajjadis because of our worship. We're Baqiris because of the knowledge. But we're also Ja'faris because he formulated this ideology. He put it into really maybe into a full package. It was this portion of the life of the Imam. Why today we have the pride of being called the Ja'fari Shias. And it's a unique identity. It's very distinct. To give you just one example of a personal example that happened to me. One time I was praying at my previous job. And a brother from one of the other schools of Islam came into the prayer room. And he said, let's pray Jamaat. So I said, okay, go ahead, lead. And he says, no, you go and lead the prayers. So I said, okay, I'll lead the prayers. He didn't know what madhab I followed. I didn't know what he followed, but it didn't matter. We were Muslims at the end of the day. And that's how we should look at it. I led the prayers. I prayed the way that our sixth imam showed us. I finished my salat and he says to me, brother, I've never prayed this way before. What madhab do you follow? What imam do you follow? I said, I follow the teachings of Imam Ja'far al-Sadiq alayhi salam. Sallu ala Muhammad wa ala Muhammad. A 40-year-old man, he says, I've never prayed this way before in my life. Subhanallah. I've never prayed the prayer that you are praying today of Ja'far al-Sadiq. He followed another one of the imams of the Ahlul Sunnah. I don't know which one. And it doesn't matter. But he was amazed of the prayer of Imam Ja'far al-Sadiq. Right? I didn't say I'm a Shia. Ithna'ashari. I'm following Ayatollah Fulan from this country. I said, I follow the sixth imam, Ja'far al-Sadiq. And he maybe knew that name because one of his teachers or many of his teachers who he follows probably was a student of the sixth imam. And maybe that would ring something in his head that if I'm praying like this, why did my teacher Abu Hanifa or whoever it was, why am I praying differently? So we have to understand our identity as believers. We are Ja'fari Shias. We shouldn't be ashamed of it to say, oh, we're all Muslims, it's all good. And yeah, we're all Muslims. But we have a unique identity. We have to preserve this identity. And especially in the area where we live, where we are being so, you know, bombarded with different messages, we have to realize that we have to bring up our children with a love of the identity of being the Shias of Ali Muhammad, of the followers of 12 Imams, and as followers of Imam Ja'far ibn Muhammad, alayhi salatu wassalam. Tonight I want to look at advice from the sixth imam to the youth. But there are also words of wisdom before that to the adults, because it's a partnership, as we'll see in the hadith of the sixth imam. I've carefully chosen hadith from the sixth imam for tonight's discussion, because I want to show us how he gives us this entire package of guidance. We don't need to go anywhere else when we have everything in Ali Muhammad. When the teachers are there with the guidance, there is no need to go anywhere else outside of their school. And the sixth imam, because he had that ideal time, he had the time, he had the ability, he had the freedom to express himself, he made the utmost of his opportunity to guide the community of believers, not only 1,000 years ago, but even till today. His guidance lives on. His guidance is in the books. But we have to take it out of the books and into our day-to-day life. So let me begin by this assessment that, you know, anywhere in the world today, you work for a company, you always want to do an assessment, you know, an ROI, a return on your investment. If we're going to launch a product, we have this plan in mind. They don't just go and start building it and marketing it and selling it. There's a lot of work that goes in to every product that you see on the shelf today. In fact, I don't know if I've given this example, but let me mention it. A very famous Hollywood producer, he made a movie a few years ago. It was the biggest budgeting movie, in the biggest blockbuster movie ever in history. It made over $2 billion at the box office. Billion with a B. $2 billion it grossed in the box office. I watched an interview with him of this movie and how he made the movie. He mentioned that when he wrote the script and he began to think in his mind of this movie, he realized that computers, technology, the cameras, they would not be ready until 10 years down the line. But he said that I was writing the script, I was making the movie, I was formulating it in my head, knowing that 10 years in the future, once computers can catch up, when the CGI, the computer graphics and animation and all of that can be at the peak, I can then make this movie, which he spent $300 million to make, but it grossed $2 billion. But the point is, he spent 10 years planning and waiting for the technology to get there. He was getting ready for that movie. It makes us think, it makes me think that are we planning so far ahead into the future for our imam's return? Are we putting in that thought process? Or are we just planning for what's going to be on the menu tomorrow or the next week or the next month? Or what we're going to do here or there, or all of these basic, very simple, trivial actions. Assessments have to be done at different levels. And fortunately, the sixth imam has done a lot of that work for you and I. So we don't necessarily have to scratch our minds and sit around a table and think, what should we do as a community of Muslims, as Shia Ithna Ashiris? The sixth imam gives us this very important tradition, a very powerful thing to think about, what the sixth imam is saying. Where do we put our energies? He's done the assessment already. He's shown us what we have to do. He's giving it to us. He says, initiate the process of teaching your young ones about religion before the deviant ones get to them. We have to be looking into the future. We have to be thinking about the younger generation. We live in a time, and all of you who are parents in this room, if you have children who are toddlers, this is on your mind. If you have children in elementary school, this should be on your mind. If you have children in junior high school, this should definitely be on your mind. If your children are in high school, inna lillahi wa inna ilayhi raji'un, it's too late to think about it because they're gone. Either they're on the path already, which is great, or they've diverted, which may Allah bring them back to the path. But really, it's something to think about for everybody. And if you're not at a level of having children, you still have to think about it, because the environment that we live in today, I've talked about this in the past, where things which are haram in our religion and in all Abrahamic religions are being made halal. I don't have to mention those things on the minbar. You know what I'm talking about. Those things are being taught in our schools, in our public school system. They're even being taught by so-called Muslim scholars the permissibility of these actions. You can look at it online. It's there for you to read about. When we live in such an environment, the sixth imam says, work on the youth before the deviants get to them. Right? Deviants, here the imam used an example, the Murji. They were a specific sect in Islam that were deviant ideology. But we take it in the general, not in the literal sense, but in the general sense that we need to think about our children. The assessment is there. The imam said, work at the youth. Right? And the youth can't take care of themselves. The youth need elders to help them, to support them. It's about that whole continuous process. Their children today, they get the support, they grow up to be adults. They become adults, they have children. Now it's their responsibility to work with their children, with that generation. And so we have to begin this process somewhere. And let me show through that again the hadith of the imam, the sixth imam, of where the priorities have to be. Again, we have so many things that we have to do that we want to do. You know, but we can't take on the world. We can't do everything. We want to do this and that and this and that. We want to, you know, conquer the world. We want to convert the whole world to Islam. But we can't even bring our own family to the centers. You know, we want to convert the world to become Muslim, but our own children are in the nightclubs. We want to change everybody, but we don't change ourselves. So the imam is giving us, and I'll share this with you in two stages. Priorities in our life, where to focus on. Again, because as a community, not here in this community, but globally, Muslims in general, followers of Ahlul Bayt, we have to fulfill our priorities. We have a long list of things to do, a huge checklist that we want to do, things we would like to do, things that we should be doing. But the sixth imam, again, when we go back to his teachings, he shows us to keep our priorities in order. To do things in terms of their importance. You know, again, this is so common knowledge, but sometimes when we do it at work, it becomes so easy because we have a boss and a manager telling us we have to do this and this and we have deadlines to meet. And we know if I don't meet that deadline, that somewhere down the line, there's going to be a ripple effect. And so we make sure we do it there because our paycheck depends on it. Our bonus, our year-end Christmas bonus depends on it. But if it doesn't happen in the masjid, well, it's okay. We do it next year. We couldn't do it this year. We'll do it next month. We'll do it another year. You know, there's time. The children are still young. No, we see that is not the way to think. That the sixth imam gives us guidance that prioritize and actually go and do the responsibility. So let me share with us a story that happens at the time of the sixth imam. The sixth imam is obviously in Medina at the time. He has a companion, Abu Ja'far al-Ahwal, who's from Basra. Basra is in Iraq. Distance-wise, Basra to Iraq, to Medina, is like Edmonton to Vancouver. It's about 1,200 kilometers, give or take. Basra in southern Iraq, the port city, go to Medina. It's about 12 to 1,300 kilometers. He travels all the way from Basra to Medina to meet the sixth imam. He sits with the imam, he talks to him. The imam is, you know, asking what's happening in Basra, you know, how's the weather, whatever the normal, you know, chit-chat to break the ice is happening between the two. And then the sixth imam asks Abu Ja'far a question. He says that, what's the condition of our Shias? You know, you're telling me everything else about Basra, but what about my followers? How are the Shias of Basra? How are they doing? Are they okay? Do they have any problems? Do they need anything? Do they need any help? What are my Shias doing there? And Abu Ja'far, he's not one of those yes men that would candy coat the answer. You know, sometimes we have these yes men who, whatever the boss says, they'll do it. The sixth imam realized this companion, he's going to give him the straight out facts. He's not going to sugarcoat the situation because that does nothing but, you know, really exasperate the problem. The first step to having a solution is to recognize there's a problem. If we don't realize a problem in our lives, in our families, in our community, then we walk around like everything is, you know, well, everything is good. It's like that one person who told me one time at a conference. He was a president from one of the major Shia Jamaats in the world. And he says, "Mashallah, brother, you know, none of our youth are on drugs or alcohol. They're all straight." And maybe he's correct. Maybe he knows each and every single youth in his community. But I would beg to differ, because when I look at other parts of Canada today, and you look in the newspapers, this is not ghibah, but when you have our own youth in our community who are behind bars for murder and attempted murder, you know we have problems in our community, right? Just because I don't see it, it doesn't mean it doesn't happen. But when our youth, you look in the newspaper in a major metropolitan city, and you see somebody with a name that resembles our names, and he's charged with murdering his girlfriend, not his wife, his girlfriend. That's a problem in our community. We have to fess up to it, that we are falling into the problems that the mainstream society has been dealing with for many years, unfortunately. And they haven't come to a solution. But we have the similar challenges. And we have to look and think about these and formulate a response and a solution. So sixth imam says to Abu Ja'far about the Shia, what's up with them? He says to him, he says, "Wallah," Abu Ja'far says, "I swear to God that indeed those who are your Shias are very few in Basra." And he says, "Those who struggle to be your followers, they're also qaleel, there's also a small number of them." Now he doesn't give a number. He just says qaleel, there's a small number of them. Maybe there's a handful. Maybe there's thousands. We don't know. But him saying that to the sixth imam, that you know what? There's very few Shias that I can actually call Shia. There's very few of those in Basra. And those who actually are practicing, they're even fewer and far between. Right? So this is at the time of the imam, when there was not so much corruption available. You know, corruption wasn't in the palm of their hand as it is today. Corruption wasn't as it is in today's society. And he's saying that there's very few believers. Now maybe there are multiple reasons why he said this. But whatever the case may be, the sixth imam understood that there is a problem in Basra. What does he tell him? Does he say, just pack up and move, go to the next city where there's a bigger community? You know, what advice would the sixth imam give? He gives something which I give to all of us tonight as well. Not that we are at that same level, but we have troubles within our society. We have to admit it. When we have centers where you go on a Tuesday night for Dua Tawassul and two people show up, and one is the one who controls the AV, then we have a problem. We have to admit it, there's a problem. When two people come to a program in the month of Ramadan, which is the most spiritual time for a community, and nobody shows up, there's something wrong within the psyche of the Muslim mind when that is happening. So the sixth Imam says, Alayka bil ahdath. I advise you to work on the youth. Focus on the youth. Think about the youth. What are the youth up to? Why are you not working on them? He says that they are the quickest. They are the fastest to accept goodness. And you can see this if you come to the madrasa on Sunday, here or any other community, and you see how energetic the children are, that they want to run and recite the dua for dhuhr. There's literally a competition in this hall every Sunday, who should recite the dua? Who can do the adhan? Who can do the tasbih? Who can do the ziyarat out loud? There's a competition for children in our madaris, for children wanting to be good, wanting to learn, wanting to express their Islam. And so as a community, and I'm not being paid by the madrasa to say this, I'm saying this because we have to focus our energy where the greatest return of investment is. If companies do this, why don't we do it? We try to run our jamaats like a business, cutting costs, doing this, generating income, revenue, all of this, all of that. Why are we not looking? Where is the greatest return? And you look at the children, you'll see that on this Sunday when the madrasa has a special function, how charged the children are to want to present what they've learned in madrasa. So there should never be a time when madrasa has to have a fundraiser. Not that it happens here, but we should never have that problem. We shouldn't have a problem that they don't have Chromebooks for children or tablets or you know, smart boards, because this is where the investment has to be. The investment has to be on the new generation, right? The investment, if we can spend $8,000 on a big screen TV for home, can't we spend that on the center to have TVs for the children, to have laptops for the children, to have what they get in public school for our children? This is where the investment has to be. And the sixth Imam is showing us, Alayka bil ahdath. Work on the youth, focus on the youth, go back to Basra and work on the youth, because they are the quickest to accept it. You give the youth whatever it is and they'll run with it. Give them religion, they'll take it. You give them hockey, they'll go with it. Give them what's important, what is going to benefit them in this world and the world to come. Sallu ala Muhammad wa ali Muhammad. So let me come to a conclusion in the next few minutes with the lesson from our sixth Imam. Again, there are so many traditions from the Imam of what to do, where to focus our energies. Let me focus on the youth and what they have to do, because if I just sit up here and tell the elders, you do this, 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 and this, well, the youth will just relax and say, well, they're doing everything. But it's a two-way street, right? It's a two-way street. The parents, the elders, the leaders, they have to do their job. But the youth also have to do their responsibility. They can't just sit back and relax and wait. They have to be proactive. They have to also make efforts to change their condition. They have to make steps to change the situation that they're finding amongst their own peers and their own community. And so the sixth Imam balances it out. The elders have a responsibility. The leaders have things that they have to do. But the youth, they play a very vital role in this puzzle. Just like a jigsaw puzzle, two pieces lock in together, they're interconnected. You can't make a jigsaw puzzle with just one piece, right? That's a picture. A picture with no pieces, you know, it's just a picture. But when you cut those shapes out and they interlock, that's where we have to get to, where the youth also realize they're a part of this equation. They can't just sit on the sidelines and wait for them to be given everything on a silver platter. No, you look at even in North America today, a major conference happens in Toronto every year. Unfortunately, obviously, we live far away. But I've been to this conference in Toronto in the Christmas break. 25,000 Muslims attend from all over the world in the Toronto Convention Center, a conference which was organized by youth 15 years ago they started, with a few hundred people that will attend, a few thousand people. Today, 25,000 people attend this conference over 3 days. It was organized by the youth. So they made an initiative, probably with the support of elders, but you go to it today and you see with what magnitude and what glamour they put on this conference. It blows the mind to see this event, and I've seen it live. I've been there before. So to see that by youth for the community becomes an inspiration of what we can do when youth are empowered and they themselves power themselves to go forward. So the hadith of the sixth Imam, and we'll end with this tonight, is he talks about looking at the youth, and he addresses the youth. He says, I don't like to see any youth from amongst you, from the Shia community, except that you're in one of two states. Either A, you're an alim, you're a scholar, and I'm talking about scholar of religion, not about, you know, in secular studies, which are equally important, but religious scholar. He says, I don't want to see any of my Shia youth, they're either an alim, or muta'allim, they're a student of knowledge. There's no other third category. You know, Imam Ali alayhi salam, in Najul Balagha, he has a hadith where he says either you're a scholar, you're a student, or you're a filth, you're garbage. You're the, you know, that foam that gathers on the water of the ocean. He says that's what you are. If you're not an alim, you're not teaching, or you're not learning, you're basically the rubbish of the sea. And if we don't want to be garbage of the oceans, the imams tell us either be a scholar and teach other people, or be a student and learn from other people. And then the imam breaks it down. He says that if a youth is neither a scholar or a student, he says then they have deserted the period of their youth. They've taken their period of youth and they've deserted it. And then he goes a step further. He says if a youth is not either a scholar or a student and they have deserted the youth, then they have, as he says, they've wasted the period of their youth. From there, the sixth Imam says, if they're not students, not scholars, they're wasting their time, they are deserting, they're wasting it. He says, then they are transgressors. They're sinners against the rules of Allah. So he's getting very, very, you know, at a level of thinking that we have to be in one of these two groups, because if we're not a scholar or a student, we're wasting our lives. If we're wasting our lives, you know, as he says, we are transgressors. We're going against Allah's rules because we always have to keep busy. We should never be, you know, saying, if our youth say, I have nothing to do, that's a problem. That's really a problem. Say, I have nothing to do. But he says, if they're not that, then they're transgressors. And he says at the end of the hadith, if you're a transgressor, he says, I swear by Allah that the place of the transgressor is the fire of hell. So it's something for all of us, not only the youth, to think about. All of us should be in the process of either learning or teaching one of those two positions in our life. You know, we have Maraja Taqleed, and I'm sure you've met them when you've gone for Ziyara. 70, 80, 90 years old, and they're still teaching every day a class of 1 hour, 2 hours, right? So they're teaching until the time that they're in the grave, literally. So there is never a time that somebody can say, I know it all. Right. If a marja taqlid at 90 can say, I don't know what I don't know, then that shows us that where are we in the scale of knowledge? When a 90-year-old scholar can say, I don't know a certain ruling, I'm going to have to research it. Right? And if you look at the marja's risala, whenever there's an ihtiyat ruling, a precaution, it's because he doesn't know. He says, I've done my research of 80 years, but I don't know the answer to this question. I'm going to make it a precaution and tell my follower, be precautionary because I don't know the answer. He's being humble about it. May Allah protect him. He's saying, I don't know what the answer is, so be precautionary in this area. Sallu ala Muhammad wa ali Muhammad. Let me close with a very brief summary of just what I've mentioned tonight in five words. Identity. We have to remain and retain our identity as Ja'fari Shias. We have to ensure we and our children know who we are. We as a community have to do an assessment. We saw it from the sixth Imam, but we have to do a personal, local assessment on where our needs are. Where is the greatest ROI, the return on our investment? We have to have our priorities in order. Look at the ROI and then determine what is our priority. Where are we going to invest our money, our time, our resources? Where will we get the best return on our investment in the spiritual world? We also have to realize the youth have to play an important role in this. They're a part of the puzzle. They're not outside of the boundaries. They have to be in that assessment. They have to be in the priorities, involved in the decision-making process in one way or another. And last but not least is initiative. Youth have to show initiative first and foremost. Allah tells us in the Quran that He will not change the condition of the people until they change what is within themselves. And so the youth have to make the initiative. They have to step forward and say, we want X, Y, and Z. We demand X, Y, and Z. We need X, Y, and Z. And then we work backwards through this, and hopefully we get to a point where we're able to help the community. We're able to help this next generation, as the 60th Imam showed us, to ensure that we work with the youth, because they are the ones who will accept the goodness. They are the ones who will take that forward. And it is the youth who will hopefully be the vanguards and the soldiers in the army of our 12th Imam. We close and we ask Allah on this night, we have spoken about our 6th Imam, that we are blessed to have the shafaat of Imam Ja'far as-Sadiq alayhi salam on the Day of Judgment. We ask Allah to give us the ability to also make the ziyarat of Imam Ja'far as-Sadiq in Jannatul Baqi. We ask Allah to also give the Muslim Ummah on a whole the ability and the guts and the stamina to help rebuild Jannatul Baqi to its former glory. And we ask Allah to hasten in the advent of our 12th Imam, Imam Al-Hujjah. May Allah accept our actions. May Allah forgive us any of our slips. And may Allah give us the ability to see the time of the zuhur of our 12th Imam. Rabbana taqabbal minna innaka anta as-sami'ul alim. Let us close before the ziyarat by remembering the deceased from our families, our communities, our friends, the ulama, the shuhada who have been losing their lives around the world on a day-to-day basis, with a surah al-mubarakatul fatiha, and before that, one loud salawat upon Muhammad.